Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Barbara Morgan, and you're listening to Austin Film Festival's On Story. This week on Story, we'll hear from television writer and producer Howard Gordon on his process of creating a hit TV series. Howard Gordon is a television writer and producer best known for his work on the Fox action series 24 and the award-winning Showtime thriller Homeland, which he co-developed with Alex Ganza. Gordon first gained national attention for his award-winning work on Fox's groundbreaking series, The X-Files, for which he won multiple Golden Globes. His other credits include Angel, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Sisters, and Spencer for Hire. Producer Barry Josephson spoke with Gordon at the Austin Film Festival at a panel about his process of writing for hit television. Clips of Homeland, The X-Files, and 24, courtesy of 20th Century Fox Film Corporation.
Howard Gordon's a television writer. He's a producer. He's a creator. He's an author whose incredible credits include the prolific series and brilliant series, Homeland, one of the biggest hits in Showtime's history. Every element of that show is just so brilliant, right down to many of my friends talk about the music choices that were made. You know, I was actually listening to a sports podcast the other day, Howard, and they were talking about the music for Homeland. Pretty remarkable.
That is a story, you know, in and of itself. I mean, when we thought about the score, and of course, talking music and talking to composers about music is always a very tricky thing. I mean, it may be the most ineffable thing. And sometimes people who, unfortunately, there are writers and directors who may play an instrument and they start talking in terms of minor, major, and, you know, stuff like that, and which is always the worst thing. A little knowledge can be terribly dangerous. But Alex and I stumbled upon this sort of jazz idiom thing really kind of out of character. I mean, we specifically had reference points. For instance, I mean, The Conversation, the Coppola movie, which was a really beautiful lilting waltz. But famously, there was an executive who said, there'll be no jazz on this show, you know. And in fact, that same executive actually had me swap out at Alex and I swap out in the pilot, this score, which was far more subtle than wound up, you know, with the 24 temp track, which was, and 24 was often wall-to-wall music. And it was the same composer, Sean Callery. Sean is a brilliant guy. It was a really kind of neat choice that was in the pilot episode, in the plot itself, where Carrie actually goes to a jazz club having been stymied and sees this call and response among these this jazz quartet or quintet, and recognizes that the guy, you know, Brody, has been signaling with his hands.
This is him outside his house, and here he is at Andrews Air Force Base. Okay, do you see? It happens whenever he's on camera, whenever he knows the world is watching. It's the same sequence over and over again.
A code of some kind.
He's making contact, Saul. He's sending a message to somebody, a handler, a sleeper cell, somebody.
And so it really kind of became kind of a signature thing as well. One of my first SAT students was this young woman named Tori, who was only 3 years younger than us, whose dad had just put on a show or created a show or adapted a show called Spencer for Hire, which was a private
eye show. John Wilder. Yeah.
John read our spec script and we pitched to him, and we read every Robert Parker book and we went from there. We pitched not to John, but to two of the guys under him at Spencer for Hire. These were the days, by the way, before writer's rooms. You could actually make a living as a freelance writer, and you'd pitch to shows, kind of like Willie Loman, from show to show, and you could actually cobble together a pretty good living. Those days kind of morphed. The business in the 90s, I think, kind of became writer's room driven and less freelance based. And there was another show that was launching through with Thomas called Beauty and the Beast,
right,
which was Ron Perlman and Linda Hamilton. This is like in the late 80s, and we're probably 25 or 26.
Think about how ahead of its time that was when you think about where Disney wound up, and it's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, it was a kind of a beautiful show, but it was fun. You know, it did get nominated for a couple of Emmys, so it was exciting. But John Wilder actually recommended us to Tony Thomas, and that was our first staff gig. And so we really, really, that's where we cut our teeth. Alex and I wrote, of the 50-something episodes, we wrote about a third of them. And George R.R. Martin, who's still a friend to this day, was also on staff. So, you know, it was George Martin and David Peckinpah, who was Sam Peckinpah's nephew, who unfortunately has since died, and Ron Kosler, who created the show. It was really kind of an amazing experience to be in your late 20s, mid-20s, and that was really where we cut our teeth. And then I went from there, actually, to X-Files. Alex and I joined The X-Files together, and he left in the middle of the first year, and I stayed on. We ended our partnership and our friendship remained intact and probably improved, but we didn't write together for, you know, for another 15 or 16 years.
Chris Carter somehow found you. And that room was incredible. Now, I don't know whether it was a room or people were outside. I don't know that much about the history, but you have Vince Gilligan and James Wong and Glenn Morgan. What was it like, you know, writing on that show? It's such a groundbreaking, incredible show.
It's interesting from a professional level and a creative level. Remember, the Fox network at that point was the fourth network. And there was a pretty significant question as to whether it would even exist at that point. We were, it was a Friday night show, and our agent tried to encourage us not to do this show, but we thought it was, I mean, it was an amazing pilot. And it was a 9 o'clock Friday night show. So he referred to it as a hat size show. I didn't know what that meant, but I guess hat sizes are single digits. So it was like there were no expectations and that the show would ever do anything. It was like the little engine that could. It really became this unexpected hit. And it kind of became a global hit. Within a year, it wasn't all at once, but kind of in pretty short order, it was like being in a garage band and suddenly you're part of something that, you know, it's everywhere. I mean, I can't understate the high that felt. I mean, I got a taste of it on Beauty and the Beast. We got some attention, but this really was a big hit, a defining show, and a profitable one for many, many years for Fox. And we were just a bunch of guys who expected nothing of this Friday night hat size show. And so we didn't know what, we kind of sensed it was good. And Alex and I, part of the reason we split up on the show was Jim and Glenn, Morgan and Wong were so good. They just got the show in their bones. For us, we felt we had to work kind of twice as hard for half as much. And if this were, you know, to beat a baseball metaphor to death, these guys were hitting triples and home runs seemingly effortlessly. And Alex and I, if we were lucky, hit a double.
Was it a sci-fi intellect?
It was a filmography. Their ability to sort of, their filmography and their grasp of like B movies and their ability to sort of take it and sort of put it through the prism of the show. And you know, you can see the influences on a lot of their shows. If you're a film buff, you really can see how steep they were in that genre. Alex and I always were much more character-based. And so we always found a character who interested us and built from there. But they were great storytellers. It just turned out to be a great thing for them. And look, it was challenging and competitive and exhilarating and complicated. But, you know, Vince Gilligan, I do remember having read Vince Gilligan's script when he was just out of NYU. And now he'd been already successful in so far as selling a couple of scripts that hadn't been produced yet. He came and joined the show later in the year. Darren Morgan, who was Glenn's brother, won an Emmy. Again, I would tell anyone who's a student of television to check out his episode in season 4 called Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose with Peter Boyle. It's one of the greatest episodes of television I've ever seen.
Could you tell me an episode of X-Files that you wrote that you guys just loved and thought the execution was as good as what was on the page?
There are two episodes that come to mind. And again, this is with all the humility of never feeling like I wrote one of the classic episodes. I don't know that any of mine are in the top 10, but there was one called Kaddish, which is actually about the golem myth. I did it in season 4 that I was very proud of. There was low hanging fruit on a show like X-Files. You have only so many vampires and zombies and aliens and resurrections. And this was sort of an iteration of the Frankenstein myth.
The early Kabbalists, they believed that a righteous man could actually create a living being from the earth itself, fashioned from mud or clay. But this creature could only be brought to life by the power of the word. In practical terms, by the direct application of certain secret letter combinations.
Combinations found in that book?
Mm-hmm. See, these pages, they're basically instructions for animating the inanimate.
So this monster was created as a defender of the persecuted Jews in what was then, what is now Czechoslovakia. But he's a monster and gets away. And I found a way to make it a love story. So it was just finding the right aperture or the right foothold into the story. And it was fun. And it's had some longevity. People have continued to reach out and get to see it. And I really like that.
Tell me about how you wind up on Angel and Buffy and working with Joss.
There's this show that nobody thinks much of by this really talented, you know, this kind of wunderkind, Joss Whedon, who had written the movie that didn't do very well called Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And David Greenwalt, who had been on The X-Files, was the more mature writer, showrunner who was paired with Joss at the beginning. of that show. And so David, who'd been on The X-Files, asked me to join Buffy in the second season. You know, Joss, again, had that crazy ability that Morgan and Wong had to quote, you know, he knew what happened in Act 3 of Henry VIII, but also in Issue 3 of Spider-Man, Volume 7. I mean, and he could mash up these tones in a way. He also had a tremendous staff. I can't underestimate the importance always of having, you know, a showrunner really has to sort of be more of the conductor and the band leader. Joss trained a group of people who were raw enough in their sensibilities and in their careers that they really, he kind of created them in his image and they wound up singing in his key. He's one of the few writers, Joss, who started at the end and worked backward. He knew where this season, he really had this, he had it in his head. I've never seen someone have it. So he may not have known how he was going to get there, but he knew where it was going. And I think he knew where it was going, not just seasonally, but on an episode by episode basis. There was always this moment that blew your mind that he was working toward. And once he knew he had that moment in his back pocket, he could take his time getting there.
And is there an episode of Angel that you sort of love, that you felt really complete on having written? Where you feel that Joss read it and thought, that's fantastic, Howard, you get it.
It's funny because I think writing is always an opportunity to sort of reflect on some kind of truth or something that moves you in your life. I'd been to Rome with my wife. There was a sculpture called Il Pugilista. It was actually from 600 BC, and it was excavated during the Renaissance. And it was this amazing thing of this. It looks like a thinker. It looks like a Rodin, but it's a big hulking guy with scars. You could see the scars from, he was like a slave warrior or a gladiator. But the expression on this 2,800-year-old guy's face inspired me to write this underground sort of fight club type story for Angel.
Our next contest features one of the more popular fighters we've had the pleasure of presenting. A rare find, hailing from the barren wastelands of Trajo, a true champion who's got it all, skill, speed, and strength. Let's give it up for the menace of Venice, the titan of terror, the avatar.
And it was just fun to sort of take this detail that somebody created 2,800 years ago, and then you can make an episode of television out of it.
Segueing to 24. Did you know from watching that pilot that conceptually this what felt groundbreaking and like this could work and that this could sustain?
No. On the contrary, I thought, how the f*** are we ever going to do this? I mean, this is impossible. And all these things, I think when you attach yourself to a little fear, I mean, there was no doubt the pilot was brilliant and really ingenious. It took the form. It's a for those of you who haven't seen it, you know, it's a real-time show.
The following takes place between midnight and 1 a.m. on the day of the California presidential primary. Events occur in real time.
It's a really hard thing. And then, of course, there's the Kiefer part. Who knew that Kiefer Sutherland, again, who had done a pilot or two before and who's own movie career, you know, wasn't necessarily, you know, happening at the level it did when he was younger. It was the most perfect casting choice. I think one thing is that somebody else at the network wanted to cast Jeff Goldblum. Now, it would have been a different show for sure, but I can't imagine it would have been the show it became.
It's really interesting. You know, you mentioned career that I've had, and I was so fortunate to have met Boreanaz and Emily for Bones. As a film executive, I worked on Men in Black, and that was Tommy Lee Jones grounding that with Will and Bad Boys and In Line of Fire with Clint Eastwood. Sometimes a role and the writing and the execution, you look at the actor and you think, okay, it couldn't have been anybody else. It just had to be this person. And I agree with you. The first time I watched 24 and I had known Kiefer's work, and you watch Kiefer and he had that thing that, you know, Bruce Willis had in Die Hard, you know, like where you just, he owned it. The dilemma, the circumstance, you could read it on him. He performed it perfectly.
You're absolutely right. And when you think about it, ultimately it was a very pulpy, when I say pulpy, improbable. I mean, all those things can happen, obviously, just when you, in the course of 24 hours, but he sold it. What made me connect to that character, and it had everything to do with what you mentioned just now about Kiefer and about conviction. I was at a point in my life when I was, you know, in my late 30s, I was married with young kids, and I was a workaholic. I mean, I just worked 24/7 and I wasn't saving the world, but I may have nearly screwed up my life a couple of times because of this, you know, outsized work, I don't call her work ethic, I call her workaholism. And I really, and Kiefer, Jack Bauer was a guy who had blown his marriage, was trying to put it back together and sort of save his family. And again, I wasn't saving the earth, but I was definitely feeling like I got that character as a man. I appreciated that. And that's what I connected to.
So, is she still giving you the cold shoulder?
If by she you're referring to your mother, I'd appreciate it if you call her by her name, Mom. And no, she's just busy.
She's busy a lot.
And it's a school night for you, so time for bed.
I'm glad you moved back in, Daddy.
Me too, sweet.
I really want to talk about Homeland because for all the reasons I stated, there are seminal shows that brought us into off-network hits, Sopranos being one and Homeland being another. And Alex and you hadn't written together for a little while. How did that come together?
So Alex, by then I'd hired him on 24, where he did a phenomenal job in the last 2 years, season 7 and 8. And I said, maybe I'll write this with Al and let's see what happens. And so I showed it to Alex. And again, it wasn't like a no-brainer, but we sort of talked in the margins of 24. And it occurred to us that there were a lot of things, a lot of questions that we were asking ourselves at this point, 10 years into the war on terror. Again, it was 10 years, it was in 2010. And 9/11, you know, we had invaded Iraq. You know, we had these two wars that were not going very well. And we were amazed, too, that there were no soldiers, American soldiers on the air, on TV. And it was amazing. Kind of impossible. So that question, and Hatoufim, the Israeli version, is about two prisoners of war who've been in prison in Syria for 20 years and are released through negotiation. So ours, we sort of mashed up the two characters. So there were a series of epiphanies that took a slow burn about, and also we wanted to make it more of a thriller. I mean, in some ways it owes more to Manchurian Candidate than it does to, you know, there was no Carrie, there was no Saul. So it's like one piece of creative work speaks to another. We're all related in it. And it certainly inspired us to build this story around this character. And even at 24, because it loomed so large, we almost had to sort of create a hero who was the antithesis of Jack Bauer. Okay, if Jack's a man, we need a woman. If it's going to be, if he's a man of a certain age, let's make her Chicken Little. I mean, so it was like a series of things. And the essential questions that animated the show were like, what is this war on terror? Like, what's the price we're paying as a country, our values, our privacy?
You're suggesting that Abenazir planted intelligence on his own safe house just so we could recover Sergeant Brody?
I realize it sounds like a reach.
To say the least. Why not just drop him near a checkpoint, make it look like he escaped? Why would you sacrifice 13 trained fighters?
Because Abenazir is playing the long game, and this way no one suspects a thing.
Except you.
Yeah, except me. No. And Sergeant Brody's due home from Germany tomorrow morning, which gives us just under 22 hours.
To do what?
To authorize a surveillance package, to tap his phones, wire his house, follow him wherever he goes.
And they were all very confusing questions, not with any clear answers. We weren't waving a flag, but we were kind of working through some real questions we had as people being alive at that time. And Homeland became a great way to work through some of those questions.
Claire and Damian were so perfect, and their characters are so brilliant.
You know, it's funny, I think Mandy really looked at that character as like something, someone he aspired to be, that calm. Look, we wrote this for Claire Danes. The character was called Claire when we wrote our first 30 drafts. That character, she had done Temple Grandin for HBO, and she was exactly like in the, you know, the sort of beautiful but slightly broken, really smart, fiercely smart kind of person. She was just who Alex and I, just to locate and picture the character, named her Claire, having seen that. And then it didn't even occur to us, though. And we made her, and then we just changed the name to Carrie and sent it to her. She was the first person we sent it to.
Again, oh, fantastic.
Yeah. But Mandy was a little harder, but we knew he was an outsider. And again, was her mentor. The axis of the show always was those two people.
Tell us a little bit about the pilot, about scenes in the pilot and things you felt we need to set this up for the future.
You know, we took three different stabs at the pilot. Look, it's a very simple construction. There's someone who's like Chicken Little, this woman, says the sky is falling, she may be crazy because she is bipolar. So she has this outsized responsibility for 9/11. And this American hero, this guy is sprung from a prison. He's thought dead and he's brought back to this country. And everybody thinks he's a hero and he's groomed for politics and he's reunited with his family, which is its own troubled sort of other, you know, story. But she is the only one who has this theory based on an informant who's since been killed that he actually has been turned. And you understand that she is now desperately racing to this informant who's about to be executed by the Iraqi authorities, where she gets that, where she hears from him moments before he hangs that, and we don't know what this guy has whispered to her, but he's whispered something. Now it's 10 months later and she's back and she disobeys her boss's orders to stay away from the guy.
You said you were an important man. You said you had information about an attack by Abu Nazir.
I have information.
Prove it. Because unless you do, I won't protect your family.
So you know right away who she is. And again, to find with that kind of concision a character who's insubordinate, fearless, you're just drawn into this character who says F- it, and gets to this person, and she's dragged out by the guards seconds after having heard something, which we the audience don't hear yet. And we find very shortly. So that was that's just starting on the first few pages. I mean, it was so good.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and the National Endowment for the Arts, on the web at arts.gov. Support for On Story comes from Bogle Family Vineyards, sixth-generation farmers and third-generation winemakers, creating sustainably grown wines that are a reflection of the Bogle family values since 1968. This show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Jamal Knox and Colin Heyer. Our editors are Jamal Knox and Travis Neely. Music is by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from SoundLab Inc., Travis Kennedy Sound, and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about Austin Film Festival and Conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.